Wisconsin State Senate Committee on Natural Resources made changes last week to a bill that would create a grant program to help local governments deal with PFAS pollution. The amendments would make it tougher for the DNR to require testing and cleanup from what the bill classifies as innocent landowners. PFAS, also called forever chemicals, have been found in water supplies around Wisconsin. High exposure to the chemicals is linked to a variety of health problems, including certain cancers and infertility. We're getting an update on that legislation right now, and in just a bit, we'll find out why some of Wisconsin's toxic PFAS waste is getting shipped to a landfill in a rural, largely black community in Alabama. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how things like firefighting foam and other PFAS-containing chemicals get disposed of, what it means for water safety? Is this an issue in your community? Do you work in a fire station or other place that has maybe some of these chemicals lying around and you're wondering what to do with them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Can you start by telling us about the core of this bill, this idea to grant communities money to help address PFAS pollution? What is the plan for this money?
Yeah, so it would do a variety of things. One big thing, it would establish a grant program for municipalities to address PFAS, and it would also set up a grant program for people who are considered innocent landowners. So it would help municipalities and landowners test for the chemicals in their water and wastewater treatment plants or wells, and it would also help pay for projects or upgrades to some of those facilities.
For the funding part of the plan, is there a sense that there is agreement among Democrats and Republicans that at least that part of this bill is a good idea?
Absolutely. I think that everyone agrees that there should be money thrown at this issue to try and address this problem. There's disagreement over how that should be done.
And then that brings us up to some of the most recent news that you've been covering, changes that Republicans on the Senate Natural Resources Committee made to this legislation. What came out of that?
Yeah, so if you look at the initial version of the bill and then at what has changed since then, there was an attempt to expand some eligibility for grants to privately owned landfills, and lawmakers also attempted to spell out who is considered an innocent landowner that's eligible for the money that's available under the budget, and they made some tweaks that would affect the DNR's ability to pursue enforcement action against anyone that's eligible for a grant under that innocent landowner program.
Can you talk about what that means for the DNR's ability to test for PFAS chemicals in some cases?
Yeah, so, you know, as part of the bill, it would limit the DNR's ability to conduct testing. They also wouldn't be able to prevent or delay projects based on the presence of PFAS contamination unless there's substantial risk to the environment and public health or other limited exceptions. But related to the testing piece, like, they could only do that under that program if they had probable cause to believe that it would exceed state or federal standards. And Democratic State Senator Dianne Heffelbein said she couldn't support the bill for that reason because that wouldn't help when the state currently lacks groundwater standards for PFAS. And that's important because about one third of state residents have private wells that draw from groundwater. So they wouldn't be required to test in that case.
What kind of concerns did Democrats on that committee and environmental groups raise about how innocent landowner would be defined and how the DNR testing might or might not work?
Yeah, I think the bulk of the concerns regarding this innocent landowner question is, will there be people who are eligible for this money that shouldn't be? There's fear from residents and environmental advocates that corporations who potentially caused PFAS contamination wouldn't be held accountable for cleaning up that pollution and that that cost of that cleanup would be shifted to taxpayers. And then Democrats, again, voice concerns about limitations on the DNR's authority because they don't want to tie the hands of that agency to be able to address and clean up these chemicals.
Then on the other hand, a coalition of businesses, you write, Danny, including the group Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, also opposed the amendments that changed some of the definitions here. Why were they opposed to that?
So they were opposed to the bill because it excluded manufacturers under these changes to the Innocent Landowner Grant Program. They wanted to make sure that businesses with property that's been contaminated through no fault of theirs to be eligible for those funds. And the way the bill is currently written, they say it's unclear whether businesses would be eligible for that money. So you have environmental groups saying it's too open-ended and could potentially provide public money to corporations, but then business interests say it's not specific enough to make sure that they can tap that pot of money.
There's still a long road to go with this legislation. Danny, what's next?
So the bill can now head to the full Senate for a vote, but it's not yet been scheduled as far as I'm aware, and lawmakers would have to vote on it there in the Senate before it heads to the Assembly. And if it passes there, then it would go to the governor, but Governor Evers' spokesperson hinted that it may be vetoed because they were disappointed with the legislation and how it turned out after months of working on the proposal with them.
Danny, thanks for bringing us up to date today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, with us to talk about amendments to a state bill that would create grants for dealing with PFAS contamination in communities around the state, but could limit the DNR's ability to require some testing and cleanup. Now, these PFAS chemicals are found in a lot of consumer and industrial goods, including firefighting foam. Wisconsin is currently trying to help fire departments get rid of foam, and much of it's getting shipped to a hazardous waste landfill in Alabama. The site is located in the rural, largely black community of ML. A new story from Wisconsin Watch looks into how residents there feel about other states bringing their toxic waste there and concerns that it's a form of environmental racism. Bennett Goldstein is a reporter for America Corps, report for America Corps member, with Wisconsin Watch, where he covers water and agriculture. He's co-author of this story. Bennett, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a reporter for AL.com in Alabama. She's a former Mike Simonson fellow with Wisconsin Watch and WPR. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Bennett, let's talk about this key chemical that's part of the PFAS story, firefighting foam. When it comes to disposing of toxic waste like this firefighting foam, what kind of options do municipalities or airports or fire departments have?
Sure. Well, there are no federal requirements for disposing of PFAS because it's not considered toxic waste. So it's really left municipalities and states on their own to determine what they're going to do with it. So for instance, in states that have designed PFAS collection programs, some have decided to incinerate their foam. But the problem with doing that is it can release PFAS back into the environment if it's not burnt at a high enough temperature. And for those very reasons, some states have decided not to do PFAS collection. Like other states, like Colorado, for instance, paid fire departments to store their foam. And then like Wisconsin, other states such as Michigan and Indiana contracted with a hazardous waste landfill to store their foam there.
Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about ML, Alabama, where some of that foam Bennett was just talking about is going?
Yeah, so ML is in what's called the Black Belt region of Alabama, and it's a fairly rural, remote part of the state that is called the Black Belt because of the darkness of the soil and the richness of the soil. It was sort of the heart of American slavery and cotton production and is a mostly black area, mostly very poor area. And there have been issues there that have come to attention nationally and internationally in recent years about people's sewage systems not working and sort of basic fundamental kind of infrastructure issues that we take for granted in most of the United States. So ML is a small town in the Black Belt, kind of near the Mississippi border, sort of southern central Alabama.
And you talked to local residents in the area, Sarah, and looked at the history of the hazardous waste dump there. Can you tell us a little bit about the controversy surrounding it from when it started, before this PFAS was really a big issue?
Yeah, so like some interesting, I think, historical context is that this landfill was opened in 1977 by the son-in-law of then Governor George Wallace, who I'm sure most listeners will know as a strong segregationist governor from Alabama. And it was an era when the United States was first regulating waste disposal. And so it was sort of this burgeoning industry. And So Governor Wallace's family, you know, had the connections to open this landfill, and Alabama also opened several landfills throughout the state. It has one of the vast, you know, considerably more landfills than any other state. And ML landfill itself was pretty quickly like the largest landfill in the country. So it takes toxic waste, and there wasn't a lot of regulation back in the times when it opened. And a lot of local residents didn't know about it and didn't approve it. And then they kind of found out about it some years later, when some local activists kind of rallied around its presence and tried to sort of shut it down. And it became a pretty big issue in Alabama, gained some, you know, attention into the 80s, Alabama being called like the pay toilet of America. And people were, you know, had real questions about what it meant for those materials to be buried in the ground in a mill. And one of the reasons that the landfill said that they were placing it there was is that there's a specific kind of rock in that part of the ground that is not very porous and supposedly protects the groundwater beneath, which supplies drinking water for much of the region. So that was how it got to Alabama and why the infrastructure is what it is today, where there are these kinds of toxic landfills in places like the Black Belt and maybe not in places like Wisconsin.
And Bennett, what do we know about the success of this facility in preventing leaks and how safe it is to store something like this PFAS foam in a facility like that?
Sure. I mean, so hazardous waste landfills are designed to last for centuries, and they do have a lot of safety mechanisms in place that your average city landfill would not. You know, they certainly, you know, they have two liners and leak detectors and collection and treatment systems. And when liquids run through a landfill, and which is known as leachate, at a hazardous waste facility like ML, they will collect it and then try to solidify it so they can rebury it. And like Sarah was saying, you know, because it's located above, you know, this area called the Selma Chalk, you know, the landfill claims that, you know, it's only, and studies have indicated that any water that percolates through the ground is going to take thousands of years before it reaches those aquifers. However, I mean, the track record of this landfill facility is not perfect. And, you know, there have been violations documented throughout, you know, the last, well, you know, 30 or 40 years. You know, for instance, you'll find containers in a recent inspection, investigators found that there were containers that were rusting and damaged and some were leaking. There's even a spill that investigators claimed had been uncleaned for roughly 2 years, and some of the floors that are designed to be impermeable to leakage were cracked. So, you know, I think it, you know, does go to show that these, you know, systems are certainly not perfect. But at this point, there is no evidence to indicate that there has been contamination of groundwater due to the landfill or PFAS foam.
We're talking to Bennett Goldstein and Sarah Weitz-Kotacek about the reporting on PFAS chemicals being disposed of from Wisconsin by getting moved to a hazardous waste facility in rural Alabama, a small Black community there right next to the hazardous waste landfill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what happens to waste like this and the risks it can pose and how it makes its way from Wisconsin to Alabama? What do you think about the practice of shipping these chemicals to a rural, a largely Black community like Amel in Alabama? Is PFAS a story in your community right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Sarah Weitz-Kotacek and Bennett Goldstein. They're two of the authors on a new Wisconsin Watch investigation into the state's PFAS disposal program that sends thousands of gallons of toxic waste to a landfill in Alabama. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Your experiences maybe with PFAS in your community, in your workplace, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, you were talking about some of the early opposition to the hazardous waste site. In your piece, you talked to people about this recent news about Wisconsin PFAS headed there. A variety of opinions, it seems like these days, on the role, the value, the concerns about this hazardous waste facility and this waste coming from here in Wisconsin. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, I think like most of the residents I spoke with were somewhat concerned about living near this toxic waste. And they said, you know, we don't really know what we don't know. I met some guys in a restaurant who were saying they had heard that some new chemical was coming. And, you know, I doubt that they would have heard that PFAS was coming, but it sort of sounded like speculation. Whereas some people didn't really know that it was there. They were younger, maybe had grown up around it and just weren't aware. So it's been there for many decades now. And I think people feel somewhat, I think it's fair to say, resigned to it being there if they are concerned, aside from a couple of local landowners who own property next to it, and they've been kind of the most vocally opposed in public meetings, perhaps the only people who are still attending public meetings from the public about this. And I would say local leaders like the mayor of Amell, you know, he said he was focused on his health and felt that there was really limited that he could do, and he, you know, he's taking care of himself and health wise, but just felt like Amell doesn't really have the resources to test anything or see if there's a problem, and they're pretty, I guess, used to that mentality or way of life.
Bennett, I want to go back to the beginning of the story. You visited with the Jefferson Fire Department here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about what they were hoping to get rid of there? Set the scene for us.
Sure. So, I mean, they're, you know, one of hundreds of departments around the state that have decided to get rid of their foam. And, you know, when I was there, you know, the company that the DNR contracted with arrived and was able to just, you know, get out a forklift and a box truck and, you know, physically just remove, you know, rows of plastic pails of PFAS containing foam concentrate. And once it was loaded up, they also did a careful procedure where they would wash out the insides of the department's firefighting trucks that previously had PFAS foam inside of it. And then they would collect, you know, the water that they use for that. And then that also would end up in a vacuum truck. And eventually, once those materials are collected, they would all go to a centralized location in Wisconsin, and then would, once enough had been collected, would travel down Interstate 57 all the way down to Amell.
And Sarah, this issue, you focused particularly on this one site in Alabama, but there are wider concerns that a lot of dangerous waste sites end up in low-income communities of color around the country. Can you talk about this as a wider issue?
Yeah, so we looked at a 2007 study that found that people of color make up 56% of the population in neighborhoods near hazardous waste landfills. And that gets higher at 69% when there's two or more facilities in the neighborhood. So there are a range of quality of life factors that go along with living near a hazardous waste landfill beyond whether or not the water, for example, is contaminated. There might be, you know, the anxiety or just the eyesore, property value issues. Some people say, you know, brings jobs to the community. Other people say it drives away other businesses. So it's a complex situation, but one that plays out in many poor communities of color in the U.S.
And Bennett, do you get a sense that in talking to, you know, state officials and others involved in this chain that this is the end of the story? We're gonna find hazardous waste facilities. That's going to end up where all the PFAS goes, and that's it?
I think it's really unclear what's going to happen, at least from my perspective. I mean, the DNR, you know, did what it was thought was, you know, is good for Wisconsinites. And I mean, there really, when it comes to PFAS, are very few options. And I mean, they were really, have spent years designing this program, trying to be responsible. And I just think that this case shows that even well-intentioned actions can have consequences. And but they have taken steps, you know, that do show increasing attention to issues of environmental justice. They hired a policy advisor last year who specifically looks at the DNR programming. And, you know, she told me that they're trying to, you know, better engage with communities that are impacted and to try to include their voices in decision making. So, you know, what that means in practice, I'm not sure. I would certainly love them to tell me. But I, you know, I think that this is a sign perhaps that these issues will be at the forefront when future state programs are designed.
That's the big question here in Wisconsin. And Sarah, at your end of the story in Alabama, what are you watching for next?
Well, we've had some discussion about whether it would be possible to maybe test some of the water in a Amel, and you know, there's not necessarily reason to think that there would be an issue, but just to get that clarified. And you know, these landfills have been in Alabama for a long time, and I don't know that there's much legislative conversation about making a change on that front. But we're interested to hear more about the community reaction to our reporting, and you know, have heard from some people about it. So I'm curious to see if it starts some kind of public conversation.
Sarah and Bennett, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bennett Goldstein is a Report for America Corps member with Wisconsin Watch, and Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a reporter for AL.com. They talked with us about their story on the hazardous waste landfill in Alabama that takes a lot of Wisconsin's PFAS chemical waste and how residents there are feeling about it. You can find a link to the full story at WPR.org/centraltime or at wisconsinwatch.org.